the nice things about pigs and genetics is that they can have they can start having offspring at about 7 months of age on average, and so that's a quick generation interval. And they have lots of pigs, so we can select only the best ones to be parents for the next generation. But the truth of the matter is, the more traits you select for, the slower progress you make in any one of them.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. SUNY, we provide value-added. MetaFarms, transforming agriculture with data-driven solutions for pork producers. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can improve your pig's vitamin D status. Hi-D offers pure, proven performance to help your pigs thrive.
Today's edition, latest edition of SwineNet Podcast. I'm Jared, your host, and today we have a very distinguished guest, Dr. Max Rothschild. Dr. Rothschild was a retired animal scientist at Iowa State, and he's a premier geneticist. He's lifted Iowa State to international status. So very good to have you today, Dr. Rothschild, on a podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation. I'd be happy to just say a few things about my background. So I'm trained as a quantitative animal geneticist. I came to Iowa State in 1980 to work primarily with pigs. And since 1980, I've worked both in quantitative genetics and molecular genetics. And over the last 40 plus years, myself and my colleagues and my students have been working on primarily problems that address pig genetics and industry problems that we think we can help with. And so we've worked with problems related to structural soundness in feet and legs. We've looked at disease resistance issues. We've identified genes that control traits of interest like growth rate, feed efficiency, and litter size. And in more recent years, I've done a lot more international work, both in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And now I recently retired, and I actually am a genetic consultant for pig companies and other types of genetics companies.
A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes methionine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
Very good. You've had a wide, a long career across many experiences. Putting on my producer's hat, I think about, we talk about geneticists all the time, maybe not in a good light, but we always think, well, if they would just ask us, we'd tell them exactly what we want. You know, we want a sow that has a high born alive, you know, their progeny, very feed efficient, low mortality, low pre-weaning mortality. But it's really not that simple, is it?
No, it's a matter of patience as much as anything. You know, one of the nice things about pigs and genetics is that they can have they can start having offspring at about 7 months of age on average, and so that's a quick generation interval. And they have lots of pigs, so we can select only the best ones to be parents for the next generation. But the truth of the matter is, the more traits you select for, the slower progress you make in any one of them. And so one of the things that's really been a boom for pig breeders is that crossbreeding works so well. So what we like to do, of course, is select for certain traits in the male lines and certain traits in the female lines, cross them up, and then produce the kind of pigs you want. But we try to listen to producers, and certainly we get some things right. And over time, we've gotten some things wrong.
Right. Well, you know, you've transcended a lot of years. And when you first started out, what attracted you to pigs?
I had worked with pigs in my undergraduate days at the University of California, Davis. I worked on a little 30 sow, 30 Duroc 30 Duroc South farm that the university had. And I just enjoyed their smart animals. Like I said, they have large litters, so they're great for geneticists. I did some work with cattle. You know, you turn one generation a year and they only produce one offspring. It's not very easy to get a genetics experiment moving with that kind of data.
For sure. Yeah, pigs do lend a lot of ability to make changes. You know, thinking over the years, what have you seen? What do you think's been the biggest thing you've seen that geneticists have been able to do with pigs?
You know, I think the obvious thing is that we've made them grow faster, and they grow probably twice as fast. You know, it used to be you wouldn't get a market pig till 10 or 11 months. We now get a pig at 6 months, and it's almost 100 pounds heavier. When I started, the market weights were about 200 pounds, 210. Now people are selling pigs at 275, 285 in some cases. They were selling pigs at an inch and a quarter back fat. Geez, you can get them down to 6/10, no problem, at 260 pounds. So those are the two obvious things. Litter sizes were 8, now they're 12. Feed efficiency, I don't really have the numbers in front of me, but there's certainly big improvements. And this has come with with big changes in the environments we raise pigs. If you remember before 1980, certainly in Iowa, lots of pigs were out on the dirt. Kind of housing and the fields. Now they're all in buildings, on concrete. They're crowded, so it's more stressful, more difficult. So we've made a lot of really positive changes under a changing, pretty large changing environments.
Yeah, very sure. You know, I can remember market weight was about 240, and that had been too many years ago. And in about the same time period, we've been able to get, you know, now, like, as you say, 280, 290. And what's amazing is the feed efficiency they've been able to maintain very good feed efficiency, even at those higher weights.
Absolutely. And some of that is just a typical selection for pigs that are more efficient, others using individual genes. One of the genes that we found in our laboratory, and which all the breeding companies now use, MC4R, leads to the single gene itself, 5 to 8% improvement in feed efficiency. So there are a lot of things we've done to make things and make pigs better.
Now, speak a little bit, as you talked about, you've been able to map a lot of the pig genome.
That's right. Well, we started, When I was an undergraduate student, I took a course in DNA, and we thought that was pretty revolutionary. We take that all for granted now. The human genome was mapped in about 2001, the initial maps. The pig maps, we started getting some reasonable maps in the late 1990s, and now we have a large number of the pig genome has been completely sequenced. We know we have between 25 and 30,000 genes. We know their approximate order. We're starting to understand what those genes do. Most breeding companies are selecting using what's called genomic selection. So they're genotyping pigs for sometimes as many as 100,000 genes and then using that in a formula, a complex formula, to predict which animals will be better and should serve as parents. And the other thing we do more than we used to do, when I started, the seed stock, individual seed stock producer, sold almost all the breeding stock. Now the breeding companies sell almost all the breeding stock. And while that has some negative effects on individual producers, it's allowed us to have more careful selection at the top. In a kind of a pyramid structure in nucleus herds.
As you say, you made these improvements in a lot of these traits, phenotypes. What is, we always think sometimes, or maybe have opinion that when you make a change, sometimes you give up something. What do you think maybe we've given up a little bit to get where we're at?
Well, a great example of that, and we proved this from a selection experiment, is When producers and breeders started selecting for leaner pigs, two things happened. They were raising them on concrete, and they noticed they had a lot more leg problems. And what we found is that for whatever reason, some of the genes that are associated with leg structure are also linked to genes associated with leanness. So when we've selected for leanness, we've tended to make pigs a little less sound structurally. So that's required. That's required that producers and breeders pay careful attention to leg structure and select for leanness and structure concurrently. We also know that leaner pigs probably don't reproduce as well. So one of the things we've had to do is, again, select concurrently for litter size and for leanness. And that's one of the reasons why there's more selection pressure for leanness on the sire lines and less on the dam lines, because we need to keep that selection pressure for litter size and survivability. And of course, the more pigs a sow produces, there's a slight increase in the chance that those pigs will be less strong and will not survive. So we've got to start selecting more for sustainability and number of pigs at weaning, for instance.
Yeah, you know, and personally, we've seen this as a producer. You know, with these large, prolific litters, that farrowing duration now has gotten so much longer. And so we have a lot of pigs that, if you're that last pig, that number 20, you know, you're starving for oxygen and not as thrifty and tough to get maybe the amount of life-giving colostrum that you got to have.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I kind of jokingly call trailer pigs, because they come out at the end there, we've seen that. And what we notice, and this is something that we notice from Chinese pigs, oftentimes in Chinese pig litters, you'd have a pig born maybe 20, 24 hours after the initiation of labor. So, but what made those pigs more survivable is that they were more equal in size. So one of the issues that we keep wondering about is, could we select pigs so at birth they're almost all of equal size? That's very difficult, because the sow doesn't ovulate all at the same time. She doesn't ovulate 20 or 30 eggs all at once. She ovulates them over a period of time, and they get impregnated. They get fertilized over a certain period of time. So that's an area that we certainly need to work with reproductive biologists on.
Yeah. And, you know, what do you think maybe some of the management changes that as you make some of these genetic changes, as often across all industry now, everybody's it's tough with labor, trying to find people in general, and not to mention good people that want to be with pigs and are good working with pigs. So what do you think are some of the management changes we're going to have to make as we go?
Well, you know, one of the things that I saw is one of the genes that we discovered, again, MC4R, is associated with feed efficiency. And if it has two alleles, a growth allele and an efficient allele. And some of the breeding companies actually selected for the growth allele because feed costs were relatively low. And what we found was that pig's got to eat and eat and eat. It's got enormous appetite. So if the feeders aren't full, you know, if people aren't coming in and filling the feeders, and then we've got all kinds of issues. So one of the things that's starting to happen now in the industry is the combination of artificial intelligence, or AI, and the use of cameras and sensors to predict animal health. Are they feeding? Is the feeder full of feed? So I think all of this is going to produce some fascinating new traits in terms of animal behavior, what pigs do, what pigs don't do, how they feed. And of course, if the cameras are set right, it'll also predict when females are in heat, if they're off feed. So all these things, I think, will be once we get them in the buildings and figure out the best technology. And there's a lot of technologies out there that are just now beginning to be sold and be really useful, and those will help us.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think technology, we're seeing that the explosion of now we're able to see things and mark and keep data, collect data on things that we've never been able to before. I mean, could you imagine some of the technologies over your lifetime that you've seen, the advancement?
You know, it's amazing. I was talking to friends about this. And you probably know this just as well, if I put a rotary dial phone down next to somebody, they'd start punching the numbers instead of trying to figure out how to use the rotary. And, you know, the thought that we'd have a the computer that's in my phone today is probably 10 times as faster than the computer I use for my PhD thesis. So, or maybe 1,000 times faster. So it's just amazing what we have now. And there'll be more changes, some good and some probably not so good. You know, it all depends on how artificial intelligence is used. It's already been used, unfortunately, in probably some wrong ways in our politics and some other areas. But in health and animal management, it might be outstanding.
Yeah, yeah. You know, just thinking a little bit, Max, what do you think are some of the advancements that we're going to see in the future and how that's going to assist geneticists as they improve maybe quicker some of these traits or identify some of these traits?
Some of the improvements, one of the things we're going to understand a lot better is viruses. You know, certainly the COVID outbreak scared all of us. It killed lots of people. It's related to some things. But, you know, we have diseases in swine that are devastating as well. And once people start to figure out the diseases a little better, one of the advancements we're going to see is what I call vaccine-ready pigs. And by vaccine-ready pigs, I mean that we're going to have pigs that have genetically been selected. So when vaccinated, they mount a bigger immune response and more protective. That's one area. Another area I'm sure we're going to see is technology that's going to inform us about animal behavior a little better. So we can make pens, we can make environments that pigs live in to be more favorable, and maybe even help us to select more docile pigs so we'll have less tail biting, less fighting with mixed, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned a lot of different traits, behavior being one of them. How does a breeding company decide, you know, what traits are people going to be the most economical? What are people looking for? How do they decide, you know, how do you get those traits that people want?
Well, you know, I've worked now with nearly all the major breeding companies that are left and some that didn't make it, I guess. And the bottom line in all these types of things has been that they ask the producers what makes money for them. And so they try to select not only on traits that make money. So growth rate, feed efficiency were initial, litter size were initial. When some of the companies or some of the breeds have started to be more interested in meat quality, they've selected to improve meat quality. Disease is an issue that it's a little hard to quantify the cost, but clearly disease has been costly, and some companies are working now to produce, one company in particular is working to produce a PRRS-free pig using what's called gene editing. If that technique is approved by the U.S. government for food animals, then that will help produce a pig that'll be PRRS resistant. So there's traits out there that we can work on, but we've got to learn a little more biology.
As you mentioned, the PRRS and gene editing, obviously the consumer and meat quality, we got to make a product that's palatable that people want to consume. And do you think there's been maybe an overshoot a little bit on the leanness side and maybe we're starting to see more attention to meat quality and a more palatable?
Well, we certainly are. And my lab is responsible for finding, thanks to some help of some really good colleagues of mine, Dan Chobano, who's now at the University of Nebraska, for example. He and I have found two genes, CAST and PRK gamma 3. And those genes are associated with really good meat quality. The interesting thing is that the favorable alleles are in very high frequency in Duroc's and Berkshire's, which we already knew had good meat quality. And sadly, the favorable alleles are in very low quality in Landrace and Yorkshire, which, of course, we knew had bad. So one of the challenges is, can we select in those breeds that have low levels of the unfavorable allele and improve the allelic frequency? Can we make the right crosses? And then, and this is true, is some of the breeding companies say, well, the producers aren't willing to pay for that. So the problem is we need to have an agreement between what the producers are willing to pay for and what the breeding companies are willing to select for. And I think we're getting closer on several traits. Certainly disease resistance, meat quality, survivability of piglets, those are all traits that cross the bottom line, but we're never quite sure how to quantify them.
Yeah, very true. You know, customers, I think you get to the point where, as you're giving an example, breeders, producers, but even down to the customer level, you know, we want to give the customer something that it wants, but we want to also, it has to be, you know, economical. We have to get paid for it. If we're going to do something that is maybe not quite as, makes us less efficient or it's less economical, you know, we got to get that payment somewhere.
You know, people at your level are selling mostly commodity pork. So we're talking more in the cents instead of the dollars. People that sell pork at high-end pork for the white linen restaurant trade, they can afford to pay for meat quality. So we have to figure out this mix of how we operate. And some producers have gone into niche marketing. Some of it I agree with. Some I think is kind of crazy, but so be it. You know, we've got some breeds out there that people are selling at enormous prices, but the pigs are so inefficient, they have to sell at those large prices.
You know, going back to, I was just thinking as we were talking, as we've seen a huge increase in the litter size across probably most breeds. But what didn't maybe trend upward is the amount of pigs we're weaning. It's to your point, mortality, you know, has gotten higher. And intakes, you know, as animals are leaner, they eat less by nature. But we had sows that are having more pigs, but they aren't able to increase their intake somewhat. So that's been a struggle. And what do you think going forward? You know, do you see more disease and more attention to mortality?
I think that's already starting to happen. One of the breeding companies has already made a number alive at 5 days to be one of their goals. So I think there's certainly more interest in the breeding companies in trying to increase survivability along with litter size. There's one philosophy, and that is the more pigs they produce, the more they'll have to wean. There's another philosophy that says we should be selecting just on number alive at, say, 5 or 10 days, and that'll improve everything concurrently. So it's a little hard to know. I think we can improve litter size, continue to improve litter size. We can continue to improve survivability. By producing longer sows, we'll get a longer underline and have more teats. That's good. But there's a management side to this. You know, better managers know how to cross foster. So the pig that throws 20 piglets, her piglets are in trouble unless somebody knows what they're doing and cross fosters some of the extras. So it's a mix.
Yeah, it's going to take more management. You know, your point, a lot of facilities were built 20, 25 years ago. And as you're saying, now the sow's longer. Now our crates are even, you know, are too short. And so we have more instances of pigs being mashed, just no room. So I think a lot of it's going to have to take a step back and look at the way our buildings are designed, and maybe we need to make adjustments there.
Absolutely. And now with the push because of changes in certain states about what type of pigs what type of pork they're willing to buy, you know, group housing is going to change things. And traits in group housing are different than traits in crates. So we need to look at all that. I would say if I was 20 years younger and still working every day, this would really produce some fascinating new opportunities. And certainly some of my students who are still in the industry as animal breeders, they've got some real big opportunities out there to kind of fine tune some of the stuff that we started.
It's funny that it's almost like we're making a circle a little bit. Maybe, you know, we had animals that were more docile, and which is going to be important as we move into these group housing situations where now we're mixing animals. But we're taking a step back maybe from being from animals, from some of those traits that we were maybe pressing years ago. So it's kind of seems like it, maybe we're going back in a circle a little bit and going back to regressing a little bit on and seeing more attention to animals' behavior and animal.
We're certainly going to have to do more of that. When we had individual pigs out on lots, dirt lots, we had different kinds of environments and selection goals. Now, as we go back to group housing, that's going to present some things. And certainly pigs that have higher appetites tend to be a little more aggressive. So that's problematic. So we're going to have to look at all of this. And one of the things that I always found fascinating working with pigs is that they're intelligent animals. They respond, they're very plastic, so to speak, from a genetic standpoint. They respond differently to environments. And as a research scientist, that was fascinating. It's also fascinating as a consultant, because when I go to a farm like yours or someone else's, I see all kinds of different things that make me think, well, did the producer think about this? Maybe they missed this point. And that's one of the things why I still enjoy consulting, is to get out and see things and try and look with a new set of eyes.
Yeah. Did you ever think in your lifetime you would see the advancements that's been made genetically with animals?
You know, I thought a lot was possible. I'm not sure I could quantify it against what's happened now. But we have so much more to do. We're not only feeding ourselves in the U.S., but we export a lot of pork. But we ought to be looking at some of these techniques and thinking how they can be used in other livestock species in places with much harsher environments. I've worked in Africa, I worked in Asia and Latin America. They've got lots of challenges that are more than genetic. They require people to know how to feed pigs, water pigs, things that we take for granted.
Yeah, you know, it's. I think we forget sometimes that our biggest mission is we've got to feed the world. And that responsibility lies with us as producers, and that is a challenge that is getting harder and harder, as you said, in some of these areas where it's just really hard to exist and hard to have the resources available. So, and that brings, you know, is looking at a lot. You've done a great job over the years with genetics, but. You're quite a humanitarian as well. Maybe talk a little bit about some of your endeavors that you've done in Africa.
I've been very interested. You know, one of the reasons I got into animal science as a young kid, a college kid, was in the early 70s, we were worried about population explosion. Paul Ehrlich said we're all going to die because there's going to be too many people. We won't be able to feed them. And so I got into animal science to help feed people. And somewhere along the line, I would say I lost my way, but I was working mostly on helping producers in the U.S., where we're relatively food abundant. So about 20, 25 years ago, I started working in Africa, working with small producers as part of the Iowa State University project in Uganda. And it's been very rewarding. I've been happy to help lots of producers with cattle, pigs, chickens, and goats. And that helps produce food and economic security for these people. And one of the big things we need to remember is food secure people aren't likely to be interested in war or conflict. They can manage disease better. And that helps all of us, not just the people in those countries. It helps all of us.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a very good point. As we know, with animals, when we have resources, there's when there's short resources, short anything, you know, people are anxious. People are, it affects behavior.
I think, you know, that's I spent a year working at USAID when I was on sabbatical in a variety of countries in Africa and the Middle East. And, you know, food secure people are happier and healthier. And politically, that's good for this country.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, so that had to be an awesome experience as you go and maybe you list some examples of where, I mean, when you start working with these people and what you're able to do.
I'm always amazed. In Uganda and South Africa, Kenya and Tanzania, where I've been, a lot of these people are raising animals, but They don't understand any biology. And, you know, I just getting them to water, provide water full time. Now, in many cases, people have to walk miles to get water from a pump, so, or from a stream or a lake. So that's very hard to completely water. So helping them get water, teaching them about feed, teaching them about simple biology, like that. Why are you feeding that boar? He doesn't need to be 500 pounds. He needs to be 250, and the sow needs to get the food. And some of that breaks with tradition. In many of these countries, the man in the household eats first, and they think the boar needs to eat first. So we've had some great opportunities to teach people and, frankly, learn ourselves about the rest of the world.
Yeah. It all gets down to education. And I think sometimes, you know, we just need to learn more about the science behind what we do. And obviously there's, you know, I think about protein is a very important source of, you know, nutrition that is very hard to come by in many areas.
You know, the other thing about animals is, if you look historically in the United States in the 1850s and 1860s, animals were kind of like banks. People could sell them and get money when they really were cash strapped. The same thing is true in developing countries. A poor woman farmer whose husband may have died or left her, and all she has is an acre of corn or maize, as they call it there, she can't withstand a drought. But if she's got some chickens, or she's got a pig or two or a goat, she can sell those and provide money for her family, school fees for her kids. So animal source protein is extremely important for the diet, but animals also are banks. They're part of the culture in some countries. So we take for granted, it's not the same way around the world.
Yeah, I'm sure that when you visited those areas, it really probably impacted you personally, you know, just seeing what the other part of the world. We're very fortunate, like you said. It's Thanksgiving and time, and we have a lot to be thankful for where we live and what we have, for sure.
Yeah, our concern this time of year is complaining about the price of a turkey. At least, you know, at least we can put turkeys on the table, maybe a ham too. One of the things that we've really pushed at Iowa State, I think it's been fantastic, is we're trying to get almost all our kids in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences to be open to traveling around the world. And our programs in Uganda or Nicaragua or wherever we go are to open kids' eyes and teach them about the world. So they'll be, even if they come back and work as producers in the U.S., they'll have a better appreciation for what's out there.
Yeah, I think that's an awesome endeavor. You know, it hits us when we put things in perspective a lot of times, you know, when we see how things are. And for sure, that has to be pretty impactful and probably very important as you go forth and just, you know, understanding, you know, what is our mission? What are we here to do? And
absolutely.
We get caught up in sometimes in our research or what we're trying to do, but you know, we're all here trying to feed the world and try to make the place a better place for everyone. So
absolutely.
Meet AccuFast, your trusted partner in raising efficient, healthy, and sustainable pork. We're not just about genetics, we're about tailored solutions that set you on your path to success, no matter how you define it. At AccuFast, we channel our investments into three crucial pillars: our genetic offering, proprietary technology platform, and leading commercial measurement system, ensuring tangible results for our partners. Visit our website at AccuFastSwine.com or reach out to an AccuFast customer success rep to discuss how we can help you create the future you've been working towards. AccuFast, the best way to predict the future is to create it. I want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high quality, safe, and sustainable way. Anatox,
Research shows that feed sanitizers reduce the onset of viruses in commercial swine feed. Improve swine productivity through powerful pathogen control with Anatox today. Trow Nutrition North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Vaccinova. Formulate to your needs. Custom-made vaccines. Visit us at vaccinova.us.com for more info. That's vaxxinova.us.com. AccuFast. The best way to predict the future is to create it. Start creating your future today at AccuFastSwine.com. AB Vista. New nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production.
Well, our time's getting short here, and we always end with three questions.
Okay.
I'll put you on the spot, but I guess first question is, what would you say is your favorite resource?
That's an easy one for me. Bright kids. They want to learn. They want to learn, and they want to experience the world, and they just need a little mentoring and a little thought-provoking education.
Very good. Yeah, they do keep us young. I've interacted with a lot of grad students, and it keeps you thinking, you know, a lot of times. And so it's good. It keeps us young and keeps us hopeful for the future. Yeah. What do you think, Max? I know it's hard sometimes. Who do you think was your biggest influence?
Without a doubt, it was my father. My father was a chemist. He worked in the aerospace industry on some of the rockets that were built for protection of the U.S., the Minuteman, and then he worked on the Mercury and Gemini and Apollo program. He loved to think about new ideas, and he got me thinking about science. He was the driving force. And then my first major professor, A.B. Chapman, who was my major professor at University of Wisconsin. But I've had some great professional faculty members that have helped me along the way, and I can't say enough about all of them.
Very good. Yeah, it's hard to get down to one person sometimes. We have so many good influences as we think back to our careers and where we are. So, yeah, very good. Yeah. And lastly, what do you think in your field, and as a geneticist, what are some of the traits that make for a successful person, a researcher?
Well, number one, they have to be inquisitive. If you're not inquisitive, you won't go very far. Number two, you got to be willing to work with people. And, you know, one of the things I've told people all along is I'm not that bright. I've just been smart enough to hire bright students and work with bright colleagues. So you got to be willing to accept other people's positive qualities and not be narcissistic, not be worried about somebody being brighter than you are. And I think inquisitive, getting there, working with the right people, and then keeping your ears open. Louis Pasteur, said, luck favors the prepared mind. And that's a saying that I have posted on my board in my office. It's something I always believed on. And some of the biggest things I've ever thought about came by just happen chance. The gene for litter size. I was at a cocktail party and heard somebody talking about this gene in Brazilian possums. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I never heard about that gene. It's called estrogen receptor. Well, you know, then it dawned on me, estrogen, most important female hormone. Why don't we look at that in pigs? So you got to be open to listening to people and getting lucky sometimes.
It exemplifies what you just said, exemplified your career, it seems. And your point, you know, it's you may have, you know, stumbled on some things, but it was some hard work there and being in the right place at the right time obviously is important many times. So
yeah, you can't tell people that it's just you thinking up ideas while you're sitting in your chair. You got to be listening to people. You got to be listening in our industry to producers and commercial people, and work with bright people. And then if an idea seems a little off base, then maybe give it a try anyway.
Well, very good. You know, some good advice there for people that they're wanting to learn more and to progress in any field, really. You know, you gotta question and have a question, inquisitive mind, And get around people, as you said, get around people, smart people. I always think, you know, I don't have to be smart. I just have to know a lot of smart people. If you know a lot of smart people, you know, you can find things, and you're a phone call away from a solution many times.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep. Well, very good. Well, I appreciate you, Dr. Rothschild. I appreciate you being on the podcast today. I'm sure listeners have gotten a lot of learned a lot, and there's a lot of tips that we can take here and apply it to any field.
Thanks very much for asking me. It's always a pleasure to talk to people, and if I can be of some help in the future, people can call on me.
Very good. All right. You have a good day.
Bye-bye.